This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have reporter Stephen Kinzer, whose Boston Globe article on the Taliban was quite sensational.
Kinzer suggests the U.S. should and the Afghan government should be negotiating with the Taliban.
We'll also talk with ex-trial lawyer and history professor Benjamin Hett, who wrote Crossing Hitler, the man who put the Nazis on the witness stand.
Hans Litten, a three-hour cross-examination of Hitler before the Reichstag fire. He paid dearly for it. It's an amazingly heroic story with chilling parallels for today. Stay with us.
Michael, you wrote a piece on Alternet about the White House and who built it, which I thought was extraordinary. I sent it out to my whole list. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, we're here the morning after Obama decisively won the election. And of course, from a political point of view, you know, you and I, and we've said on this station, have many, many arguments about his policies. Afghanistan, warrantless wiretapping, lots of other things. But one thing can't be denied. This is an historic moment in America. And as I said in my alternate piece, what's extraordinary and what brings tears, I think, to people's eyes, particularly African Americans, but all of us really, is the fact that we're going to have a black family in the White House. And when you go back and you look online as to who built the White House and who built the Capitol and who built Mount Vernon, you see that it was built by the labor of slaves. Slaves. So here you have a black family now inhabiting a White House that was built by slaves. And in the alternate piece, I recall, you know, and you and I, Michael, are roughly the same age, the deep, deep racism in this country. Much of it, of course, is still there, but the most overt pictures of it. When I went to Florida with my mother, I went twice. Once our plane had to make an emergency landing in Jacksonville, Florida. This is the 1950s, after Brown v. Board. That's what's extraordinary. This is after 1954. We have to stop at Jacksonville to make a stop, and there's a gallery where the blacks from the plane had to sit in, and the whites got to sit in the main thing at the main terminal at the bottom. And so you saw it as a little child. I'm sitting there, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. What is this? The blacks are up in the balcony, and the whites are down on the floor. Then we maybe that same trip or another trip, we go to Miami and we go to SeaWorld. And it was just a dinky little place then with some porpoise jumping around. But you're sitting in this sort of open little arena, and you look across, and what do you see? You see a bathroom and a drinking fountain. This is probably 56, 57, 3 or 4 years after Brown v. Board. You see a fountain that says colored only. Colored only. This is in the 50s. And then, of course, I went to the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the center, of course, began its real work with Bill Kunstler, Arthur Kanoy, Morton Stavis, Ben Smith, really fighting for the end of Jim Crow in the South. That's where it cut its teeth. And at the time they began their work, late 50s, early 60s, when the center was just at its beginning, there were three, not a thousand, there were three black elected officials in the entire 11 states of what are really the Black Belt or the Civil War states, essentially, the Confederate states. Within 20 years, there were 3,000 because of the work of activists, because of demonstrations in the South, lawyers, et cetera. And so you have to look at Obama's victory in light of that. This is really an incredible moment in American history.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, there was slavery in this country up until the 1860s, and then there was Jim Crow for another 100 years.
Jim Crow, which we have interviewed and talked about in the book, we call neo-slavery, which is what it was.
Yeah, exactly. And then to think that 30 years from now, white people in America are going to be in a minority.
Well, I think that's right. This really represents something, a real change right now.
That 98% of black people came out and voted for Obama, that two-thirds of Latinos voted for Obama, that most young people came out, a lot of them for the first time, and voted for Obama. Things are really changing here. What's so interesting, I think, is that the white elite has always been able to use divide and conquer to oppress everybody, and that's starting to change. And the race question is starting to fade away. Racism is much less than it was when you and I were growing up. I didn't have any black people in my high school. And the only black people that lived in the neighborhood were the two children of a chef that worked over at a big mansion on the lake. And they weren't even allowed to go to my high school. That's no longer a situation 55 years later. Things are really changing here. And I think what's going to come to the fore, I don't know whether we'll live to see it, but what's going to come to the fore is what W.E.B. Du Bois predicted. They asked him at the end of his life, what did you think is more important in your long life in terms of oppression? Was it racial oppression or was it class oppression? And Du Bois answered, I used to think it was race, but now I think more and more it's more class even than race. And I think those questions are going to start becoming clear too as we wipe out the obfuscation of race. And I speak as somebody that lived through the 60s and was very active in the 60s. It's more exciting now. There's more possibilities now than there was in the 60s.
Right. But as I said in the alternate piece, and I think, you know, we all acknowledge is that this is one part of the struggle, this issue of having finally a black family inhabit the White House, because, you know, we still have lots of issues out there. Obama is not particularly good, in fact, bad, you could say, on Afghanistan, mediocre on Iraq at best, on a lot of issues out there, warrantless wiretapping, the issues that we've been litigating at the center from closing Guantanamo to torture. He said he would do it. This is really a time in which we have to remain incredibly active on these issues and push him, because you can already see the people he surrounded himself with are a lot of the old Clintonistas, the Rahm Emanuels of the world, the Dennis Rosses of the world, the Rubens, the financial people. Yes, this is a sea change in terms of kicking out those people who were essentially running a Versailles palace out of the White House in terms of economics. But it's not a sea change on necessarily American hegemony, on imperialism, on some fundamental right stuff. There'll be more economic stuff, I hope, going to the middle and lower middle classes and the poor, and more of a safety net. I think Obama will be better than McCain on that, but we still have a big struggle ahead, obviously.
Well, Reverend Wright said it best. He said, Obama's not a saint, he's a politician. And he is. He did everything that one would need to do to win this race. And in the course of doing that, he threw over a lot of positions that you and I hold sacred, including blowing up public financing, the civil rights and civil liberties stuff. I mean, you could talk quite a long time about everything that he turned his back on. But Obama himself said, they asked him, if Martin Luther King were alive and voting in this election, who would he vote for? Would he vote for you or would he vote for McCain? And Obama said, I don't think he'd vote for either one of us. He'd be out there in the streets. And that's an invitation.
Right.
That's an invitation. And you read his autobiography, Dreams for My Father, it's such an intelligent book and portrays a person coming of age in this racist country and looking for his own identity and trying to figure out a way forward. And you really connect with this book. And then you see his political positions in the course as they evolved over the campaign. And there's a total disconnect between the person that you read about in the book and the position that he's taking. Let's see what the resolution is to that. Let's hold his feet to the fire, or more positively, let's take him up on his invitation to get out there and organize. And let's see whether this makes a difference. Bush and his puppeteer Cheney, I mean, Cheney said the F word to Leahy. That was their attitude towards the American people. F you. They wouldn't even listen to us. Obama will listen. He's not a progressive. He's kind of a centrist liberal. But I think he'll listen. And it's our duty and our opportunity to figure out what kind of programs to put forward, how to get people organized around those programs, and how to press them. And I look forward, Michael, with you and the Center for Constitutional Rights, to do what we can about the whole host of police state measures that Cheney and Bush have put in over the last 8 years.
You know, I just got a note from a friend of ours whose name I won't mention about, you know, both what I wrote on Alternet and what we've really been discussing here. And he says, you know, and I heard this yesterday, actually, that he's thinking of, as his chief of staff, Obama's thinking of as his chief of staff, of Rahm Emanuel or possibly Dennis Ross. Rahm Emanuel, what it says in this note is his father was a member of the Irgun, a member of the Israeli army during the first Gulf War, served as, and of course, Rahm has served as chief Democratic fundraiser for congressional elections. And the other person was Dennis Ross, who was the negotiator, who also is, as this friend says, was a messenger for the Israeli position in negotiations. So as my friend says, we know what Obama had to do to win this election in terms of Israel, because that's a very significant, it's a small voting population.
Well, that's where he got his money.
Right, but it's a powerful financial part of the Democratic Party.
Sure.
Something like 40 or 50% of its money comes from the Jewish people in the United States.
And particularly in Chicago.
Right, Chicago, Florida, other places. So, right, Chicago is right. So the question is now, will Obama be able to move it at all, and will he be able to move it with people like Rahm Emanuel and Dennis Ross around his neck? I mean, we all understand that Obama understands what's going on in the Middle East. There's no way he doesn't know what's going on. I mean, he was friends of Rashid Khalidi in Chicago, the Said professor at Columbia. So he knows. So the real question is, what's his debt? What does he owe? And is he going to be able to make any movement? I do think, compared to Bush, Bush just basically said to the Israelis, I mean, most governments here have, just take a free pass, don't do anything. He didn't even have the surface of, like, trying to negotiate some kind of whatever kind of solution you want to talk about, nothing great. But he didn't even have a guy out there. I mean, Dennis Ross is gone. Everybody's gone from that administration, the earlier administration. So we'll see. But it's certainly one of the issues that I think we have to look at carefully.
No, it's troublesome, and it's just one of the troublesome issues. The fraud of clean coal, the threat of nuclear power plants, all the civil liberty stuff that he has refused to talk about during the campaign. Right. What we need to do is push him in the same way, say, that the radical Republicans and abolitionists pushed Abraham Lincoln. I think that's the analogy, right, because you have in Obama a great intellectual figure like Lincoln. We really have an extraordinarily smart, accomplished person like Lincoln. But you have a politician. Lincoln was above all a politician, and he eventually did the right thing during the course of the war. There was a huge force out there, you know, forcing him to do that, and that's what we need to do with Obama.
No, that's right. And unfortunately, of course, in those periods, you had a Lincoln period, you had a very organized group of abolitionists and others, and of course, in the Roosevelt period, you had both labor unions and the Communist Party.
Yeah.
And I'm looking around, Michael.
Yeah. No, Roosevelt started off as an anti-Asian racist, as a conservative fiscally. You had three general strikes in the country in 1934, and that's when you started getting Social Security and all the rest of it. You had a large organized left in the unions and intellectuals. Right. Coherent force. That was just 20 years after the Russian Revolution. You don't have that now. We don't have that continuity. Can we find ourselves and regroup and articulate and organize? That's a big challenge.
Right, but there's just no way to say we don't feel great that a black man and a black family is in the White House. I mean,
it was just wonderful.
You have to say,
Them and the kids on the stage. You know, this culture has changed.
Oh, I just
it changed under our eyes in the last 20 years. Popular culture has changed. The civil rights movement getting black people into the mainstream. So that you have blacks and whites and everybody else thinking that Tiger Woods is a great man and Michael Jordan and Bill Cosby and Oprah Winfrey, you know, even having a Secretary of Defense or a Secretary of State, however wretched their policies were, having them in the public view. Things have changed. So I come back to what I said before. It's not just race, it's class, and we've got to get out there and sharpen the issues and organize, and we got a chance.
I was recently pleasantly surprised to read an amazing article by Stephen Kinzer on Afghanistan and about what the U.S. should do in Afghanistan, particularly as it comes to the Taliban. Stephen Kinzer is an old acquaintance of mine going back certainly to Nicaragua in the 80s, maybe even before then. But he also has been a veteran New York Times correspondent, reported for more than 50 countries. He was the bureau chief in Istanbul. And he currently teaches journalism at Northwestern University. What was surprisingly refreshing about this article was it essentially said the U.S. has to allow, push, or it's time to start negotiating with the Taliban. I thought this was a unique perspective that I haven't heard much. I heard it from Tom Hayden a bit. I've heard it from some U.N. diplomats. Of course, it's anathema to hear that in the United States. And as Kinzer points out, really, that both candidates are quite similar in Afghanistan. Both of them are pushing for more troops, more troops, more troops. Kinzer's position is that what we're doing by the military in Afghanistan is actually creating so much damage, the U.S. bombings killing so many people, that we're essentially creating a supply of new people who want to go against the United States, new Taliban recruits, new Al-Qaeda recruits, etc. So it was an important voice to have brought out, I thought, and that's why we're pleased today to have with us Stephen Kinzer to discuss his position about Afghanistan. Stephen, welcome to Law and Disorder. I want to tell you how thrilled I was to read your piece on the Afghan war, because it's said by so few in what everybody calls the good war. So why don't you just give us the thesis of where we are in Afghanistan in the so-called good war?
I started thinking about this particularly because of the presidential campaign. despite all the differences on foreign policy between McCain and Obama, there's one thing they definitely seem to agree on, which is that we got to send more troops to Afghanistan. But this is a crazy idea. History shows us that big armies from other countries always get bogged down in Afghanistan. When you make yourself an invader, when you are an outsider in Afghanistan carrying guns and trying to impose your own political and military power, you automatically, regardless of who you are, turn yourself into an enemy of Afghans. The only way for the United States to achieve its long-term goals in Afghanistan is not to send more troops there, but to send less troops and to take a non-military approach to this problem.
Now, you try and say this, and everybody is just screaming about the Taliban. You know, they just supposedly executed by decapitation 30 people, and we saw what the, you know, what supposedly was there before the war. And aren't you going to be accused of saying, you just want to turn this place over to the Taliban? Is that what you want to do, Kinzer?
Even President Karzai, who's our man in Afghanistan, is eager to negotiate with the Taliban. He's been asking Saudi Arabia to try to arrange these negotiations, and it seems like we're going to get there. I think there's something very important for outsiders to understand, not just about the Taliban, but about the way tribal politics and tribal warlords function in Afghanistan. Many of these warlords are clan leaders with deep ties to their own group or their own people. They have shifting alliances. They move from one side to another. They could be with the Taliban today and against the Taliban tomorrow. And if they're with the Taliban, they're not necessarily against the United States. Or if they are now, they might not be tomorrow. This is a very fluid pattern. Now, the atrocious conduct of some of the radical Taliban elements reflecting the period of the Taliban rule years ago is horrific to all of us. It is precisely to avoid that kind of a draconian, brutal regime, which is going to result if the Taliban actually wins, that we need to start picking away warlords who are now supporting the Taliban and try to build a coalition that will have a broad social base in Afghanistan. This won't give us everything we want, but it'll give us what we need, which is a manageable level of violence in Afghanistan and assurance that Afghanistan is not going to be used as a base for attacks against the United States. Once we can achieve that, we should be happy.
Would you say, Steve, that that is the goal of the United States, to make sure that Afghanistan is not going to be used as a base, or is it something else again?
It's certainly true that if the United States has the long-term goal of turning Afghanistan into a kind of a proxy state, then we need to try to subdue it militarily. It's equally true, however, that subduing Afghanistan militarily, while it sounds great and might be a wonderful thing to accomplish, is not doable. Every foreign army that has fought there over the centuries has met the same fate. Right now, the Russian ambassador in Afghanistan is trying to tell the United States, don't make the same mistakes we made. You're making them. We are now, after having drawn the Russians into a terrible quagmire in Afghanistan, sinking into that same quagmire ourselves. Just what we foresaw would happen to the Russians, we now refuse to foresee will happen to us.
In the last year or so, I've been talking to a UN diplomat who was involved in both in Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. And he said to me, look, he said a year ago, he said he tried to push the United States to let Karzai negotiate with the Taliban. And he says it would have been much better a year and a half ago. He says the Taliban were weaker then. He says now, to the extent that the U.S. continues to put off allowing Karzai and to negotiate with the Taliban, the Taliban are going to get stronger, and the U.S. isn't going to be able to make the same deal. Is that how you sort of see it, or differently?
I do agree with that. I think that time's a-wasting. As the momentum in favor of the Taliban grows, the chances for a productive compromise are naturally reduced. And what is the number one recruiting force for the Taliban? What is it that drives kids to go and join the Taliban? It is the sense that Afghanistan is being invaded by a foreign force. We are the Taliban's greatest recruiters. Every time we blow up a village and kill civilians, we turn whole regions of Afghanistan against us. We need to realize that our military campaign is actually undermining our efforts in Afghanistan and is going to produce a terrible result for us. We have to get away from this can-do mentality, which has really characterized America over the centuries. In many ways, it's a positive mentality because it's what gives Americans the self-confidence to have achieved everything we've achieved over the centuries. But it has a negative side to it. Sometimes this can-do mentality gives us the idea that if you just want something hard enough and you work hard enough, whatever it is, you can get it. That may be true when you're dealing with challenges posed by technology or by other people or by nature, but it's not possible when you're dealing with challenges posed by deep-seated cultures. We have to understand that we're not going to get 100% positive result in Afghanistan. We're not going to turn that place into Switzerland. What we have to do is define achievable goals and then think very coldly, not affected by sentiment and emotion, about what's going to get us to that goal.
Let me go to a separate part of the article. Your article appears where, so I can make sure people read it?
It appeared first in the Boston Globe and was later reprinted in the International Herald Tribune.
Great. So we'll post a link on our website. But another thing you said in the article that was completely intriguing to me was the poppy business and the growing of poppies, and what is the situation now with poppies in Afghanistan, and what's your solution?
The poppy crop in Afghanistan is the source of almost all the world's heroin. It's a terrible problem. And our idea of combating it is the same as our idea of combating the Taliban. You just fight them and fight them until you crush them. But to wipe out the poppy crop is just like wiping out the Taliban. Great idea, but realistically, not achievable. You cannot just use the policy of spraying and burning and hope that that's going to end the heroin problem that's emerging from Afghanistan. So I have another idea that I think would resolve this problem in a creative and quite startling way. The total value of the Afghan poppy crop per year is about $4 billion. My idea is that since you can't wipe it all out, and you would totally impoverish many whole regions of Afghanistan, even if you were able to do so, what the U.S. or NATO should do is come up with $4 billion and buy the entire Afghan poppy crop. That way the money would not go to finance terrorists, which is what it's doing now. All that heroin you're buying on the street in Hamburg is going right to the coffers of people that are building bombs that want to fight the United States. So why not cut them all off with one fell swoop? Let's buy the entire Afghan poppy crop. We could use some of it to make morphine for our medical use, and we just burn all the rest.
What's been the reaction to your article? Because, you know, it's pretty dramatic out there to say we should be negotiating with the Taliban, because all of us, I mean, have sort of this gut instinct that we're not in love with the Taliban. So what's been the reaction theoretically? Have you gotten very much positive stuff, particularly in the U.S.? I don't just mean abroad.
I think it's been an eyebrow-raising reaction. Many people have never thought about this. We have to think more creatively about who can be our friends and who need to be our enemies in the world. We're caught in an old paradigm. We need to break out of that, because where we're going in a military direction is not taking us to where we need to be from a strategic point of view. I'm all for the United States acting in the interests of the United States. I don't think anybody else is going to do that, so let's do what's good for us. That's what every other country does. But let's think clearly about what really is good for us and not pursue policies that feel good and give us kind of a momentary emotional high, but actually wind up undermining our own interests. So what I think is the difficulty of people trying to grasp the point that I'm making is that I'm trying to say that we are pursuing our own interests by trying to reach out to some elements of the Taliban. It is not a surrender. It is a cold, calculated way to achieve our ends better than we can possibly achieve them through military means.
Steve, wasn't there early on a point when the United States actually supported the Taliban, tried to deal with them?
As a matter of fact, the Taliban grew out of that whole environment that the United States sponsored inside Pakistan when we were trying to overthrow the Soviet-backed regime in Afghanistan. There were lots of Afghan refugees inside Pakistan, and we trained them, not just in military tactics, but also we trained them to be Islamic fanatics. We distributed millions of Qurans to those people. We told them, it is your life duty to go and liberate Afghanistan from the infidel.
Oh my!
Now, we are the infidel, and they are turning their guns at us.
I'll just tell you, when I read your article, it was just a real refreshing wake-up call, I think, for all of us about what has to be done, and I just hope more people read it and at least get active on it.
Great. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder, Steve.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
About 2 years ago, when I was in Berlin, I won a prize called the Hans Litten Prize, really for my work around Guantanamo. Hans Litten was this well-known trial lawyer who cross-examined Hitler 2 years before the Reichstag fire. And they had named the Bar Association in Berlin after him when the East and the West came together. And I'd thought a lot about Hans Litten. I'd read everything I could get my hands on. And then all of a sudden, just recently, I came across a book called Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. And I always thought Litten was an important figure, important not only for demonstrating what was happening in Weimar Germany before the Nazis took power, a few weeks before the Reichstag fire, but as much also as the lessons that we have today about what it means to stand up to injustice and what it means to take away law, to what it is to live in, as Hans Litten's mother said, in a non-legal state, in a state where law has no usefulness or efficacy. Well, today we're really pleased to have with us Benjamin Carter Hett, who is the author of Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. In this book, it tells Litten's story, both the story of him as an incredibly aggressive lawyer trying to really put down and get rid of, before they had a chance, get rid of Hitler and the Nazis in the early 30s, but also Litten as a political person, and Litten really the side of him that had this sort of involvement with religion as well. It's an extraordinary book. Hett is able here to recreate the entire cross-examination, the three-hour cross-examination of Litten at the trial. And this book is really an opening and an eye on what happens to a criminal justice system and a justice system, and what happens to a country as seen through a criminal justice system where law is beginning to weaken and eventually have no usefulness at all. And of course, the story of Litten is in the end heroic, but it's also very tragic. And today we're really pleased to have with us Benjamin Carter Hett, who is the author of an amazing book called Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. Benjamin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So I was intrigued. I mean, I know who the figure Hans Litten is from my own history, and I read your book a few months ago, and I just thought it was fabulous. But why don't you just give us a little bit of background? What is this book about, Crossing Hitler?
It's the story of several things, I think I would say. First and foremost, it's the biography of this man, Hans Litten, which is something I wanted to do because I came across him in the course of some research I'd been doing, and I thought, well, here is a remarkably admirable man, a complex and fascinating man in many ways, whose complexities, I think, in many ways embody what his country was about in the 1920s and 1930s, and the story was not too well known. So it struck me that this was just simply a story that I thought should be better known and should be told. Over and above that, I think because of what Hans Litten did and the sort of centerpiece, in a sense, of his legal career was the incident that forms basically the centerpiece of this book, which is an approximately three-hour cross-examination he did of Adolf Hitler in 1931, so a couple of years before Hitler was Chancellor of Germany. And in the course of this cross-examination, Litten basically cross-examined Hitler into the ground on the issues of the advocacy of violence of the Nazi Party and the very explicit calls to violence that the party made to its stormtrooper units, while at the same time Hitler was trying to present himself as a legal operator. And that incident, in a sense, also, it made Litten very much a major figure in the German legal world, and it established him as a major opponent of the, at that time, rising Nazis. Therefore, it sort of embodied a lot of the political struggles of the late years of the Weimar Republic.
Yeah, let's lead up to that, because I think one of the fascinating things about the book, I'd known of Litten very little. I tried to do research myself. I never could find much, so I was completely amazed by your book. But you sort of look at pre-Nazi Germany, which, of course, is the night of the Reichstag fire, is the next day, I guess, is when Hitler takes power in, what, February 1933.
Yeah, Hitler took power a few weeks before that. The Reichstag fire was the event that sort of crystallized his rule.
So you try and look through what's happening in Nazi Germany, in pre-Nazi Germany, through the trials.
Yeah.
Not just the one, just this one, but others. Give us some of the thoughts, some of the threads that are running through Weimar Germany then during this period.
Weimar Germany, it's a fascinating era on any number of levels. And one of the things that makes it fascinating, and I think in many ways sort of topically interesting for our time and place, is the extent of the political divisions and the ferocity with which the political divisions were being fought out. And law was very much a part of that, because what the courts did, how the legal processes worked, how the criminal law worked, that was something that was very much at the center of a lot of the political fights, divisions, battles in the Weimar Republic. And inevitably, the political struggles of Weimar, the ongoing battles between Nazis and Social Democrats and Communists and so on, they inevitably ended up in various ways in the courts. So there's a common saying about the United States that the courts follow the election returns. And in a certain broader sense, I think what that gets at is the point that courts are not some autonomous realm where something happens that's apart from society. Inevitably, society's conflicts and its tensions spill into the courts. I think actually to study any period of history, if you study the trials of any society of any time and place, it will teach you all kinds of fascinating things about what that society is like, what the culture is like, what the assumptions are. But most certainly in a time of such monumental political fights and divisions as of Weimar Germany, the legal system, the courts, what's happening in the laws were a sort of perfect way to capture a lot of what was really at the heart of those battles, those struggles, the differences in that society.
Why don't you give us some of those differences that are going on and maybe take us through the trial that Litten was involved in, and after that we'll go back and look at Litten again.
Sure, okay. One of the curious things about politics in the Weimar Republic is that they had a very aggressive notion of what in America today we call ground game. And what that means is basically each political party had its own gang of thugs. And the job of these gangs of thugs was basically to go out day after day, find the other party's gangs of thugs, get involved in basically rumbles with them, all with a view to really literally claiming territory, grabbing hold of neighborhoods, taking control of neighborhoods to ensure political domination. And so what you have going on in major German cities from about 1929, 1930 on to Hitler's coming to power is basically you have a civil war going on in nightly installments as these gangs all fight it out.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Benjamin Carter Hett, author of an extraordinary book, Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. Let me go back to that trial, because this is the famous part of this period in Germany. Of course, Litten is very young, 28 years old or so at the time, I think.
That's right.
And he actually calls Hitler to witness stand. And is, what I got out of it was the purpose really was, as you just sort of illustrated, was Litten wanted to show that the Nazi Party was essentially a violent party. And by cross-examining Hitler, he tried to prove that. But Hitler was going to have a problem because he wanted to be a legal party in Germany. And, of course, you couldn't be a party that was extra-constitutional in Germany and be legal. But at the same time, he didn't want to disappoint the base of his party, which was this working-class violent aspect. So Litten had Hitler in a very rough position.
Yes.
So why don't you go through some of what happened in that very famous cross-examination? And as you do that, was this a big deal, even in 1931, calling Hitler before he took power?
It was absolutely a big deal. Hitler was, at that point, a major figure in German politics. A few months before that, in September of 1930, his party had scored a big electoral win, and they had drastically increased the size of their parliamentary caucus. And so Hitler had become, at this point, a really major figure. And so to pull this man, who already by that time many Germans thought would end up at some point in power, to pull this man into court and cross-examine him is a huge deal. And it was a stupendously brave thing to do, even in 1931. As to the conflicts that this trial involved then, Hitler was really in a very potentially awkward place. Just a few weeks before the cross-examination took place, it was early May of 1931, in early April 1931, there had actually been a revolt from within the ranks of Hitler's stormtroopers, the SA. The SA always being the much, in a sense, more radical component of the Nazi movement, the more revolutionary, the more violent. As you said, Hitler's desire to pose as a legal constitutional politician, which Hitler wanted to do tactically because he wanted to reach middle-class voters who would be put off by the revolutionary violence of the SA, but would vote for a leader they thought was, you know, in our terms, kind of tough on crime. And so Hitler was trying very hard to position himself as this legal guy. But meanwhile, in fact, the stormtroopers are going out, as we've said, night after night, engaged in this sort of very calculated pattern of political violence. And that's how the stormtroopers want it. And they are absolutely frustrated with this legality, which they see as sort of, you know, wimpy and conformist that Hitler is trying to engage in. So Litten here sees the wedge that he can drive right through. And Litten is hoping to really drive that wedge deeper between Hitler and the stormtroopers and then possibly fragment the whole Nazi movement. And at the same time oppose the hypocrisy in Hitler's claims to legality while at the same time he's running these stormtroopers in this kind of ongoing civil war. I think he was also hoping that he could do what in fact he did do, which is then open up a trap whereby Hitler would one way or another have to perjure himself. And then you could at the very least have Hitler for perjury, which was an offense that German courts took very seriously in those days. There were a lot of perjury prosecutions in the Weimar Republic. And if you could expose Hitler to that, and open up that risk that he would be prosecuted, then you might be able to stop him right in his tracks.
Fascinating. Now, let's go forward a little bit. First, what happened in that trial finally?
Ultimately, it was a trial of four Nazi stormtroopers who were charged with firing more or less randomly into a dance hall where a communist hiking club was holding a dance. And three of the young communists were wounded in the gunfire. And Litten was actually there as the advocate for these three young men who had been wounded.
Right. Under German law, unlike America, you can, if you're in a criminal suit, you can actually represent the victims as part of the prosecution.
That's right.
And that's what
that's
was
right.
going on in Germany. At
yeah.
the time.
They call it being a private prosecutor. And right. You can prosecute the case alongside the state's prosecution. So that's what Litten was doing. The outcome of the trial was that three of the four stormtroopers were convicted of relatively minor forms of violent assault, and they received minor prison sentences of approximately 2 years each. What everybody was watching this trial for, I mean, nobody much in the German media, which focused very heavily on this trial, nobody much was actually all that concerned with what happened to these stormtroopers. Everybody was really concerned with what was going to happen to Hitler. There was a trail of consequences that came out of this trial for Hitler and shows, in a sense, how well-conceived Litten's strategy was and how nearly it worked, except it didn't quite work, of course, as we know. But.
Right. There is actually, you have a picture in here, I think, is it? Yeah, here, of Hitler in the Berlin courtroom. It's not the same trial.
It's not the same trial.
But it's amazing to just see him standing at a desk in a similar case. So that's the trial. It takes place in 1931. I think we should do two things. One is we should go back and look at who was Hans Litten. How did he get here? And then let's go forward and see what happened as a result of crossing Hitler.
Sure. Well, Hans Litten, he was born in 1903. He was born in the town of Halle in central Germany. His father was a law professor His mother came of a family that had produced a lot of academics and clergymen. These are very prestigious professions in Germany, still today and certainly then. One of the things that's interesting and really formative about Litton's family background is that his father came from a Jewish family but had converted to the German, what they call the Evangelical Church, basically the Lutheran Protestant Church, so that he could have a career. Because basically you would not have much chance of getting named a law professor in pre-World War I Germany if you were a practicing Jew. But if you converted to the Christian Church, then all bets were off and you could make a career. And so Hans' father made a brilliant career, actually. He was a very successful professor. He became dean and ultimately rector of his university. He became something of a minor celebrity, actually, in East Prussia, where the family eventually settled. They settled in the city of Königsberg. So Litton came from this mixed background. And what's striking about Litton is almost from the beginning, from his early childhood, he was engaged in this fierce, fierce feud with his father. He and his father never seemed to like each other, and it just got worse and worse as Hans got older. And as part of that feud, he started really emphasizing his Judaism, I think initially probably as a bit of a slap in the face to his father's conversion and conformity. Litton made quite a production of, as a high school student, of going to the synagogue and walking about with his prayer book, even having friends from the Hasidic community in his hometown of Königsberg. All of this, of course, drove his father completely
wild.
And
his father at this point wants to be a very good Prussian, essentially.
Yes, exactly. Yes, right. His father prided himself, as he wrote, on being a Prussian officer, a Prussian civil servant. He wanted to be absolutely in the mold of conventional Lutheran Prussian society. So with all of this, with his political complexity, the fact that his far-left political affiliations made him a bit of a hot potato, especially in West Germany after the Second World War. Nobody much wanted to deal with that. Conversely, it made him a hero in East Germany, although...
He was dead by this time.
The East German regime had to sort of downplay the fact that Hans Litton hadn't actually liked the Communist Party too much, which was a bit awkward for them. So there's awkwardness there. People who approach him in terms of his religious motivation, it's always a bit awkward. Do you consider him Jewish or Christian or both? So there's something there. Always it's a bit awkward for some people. So he's a very complex man whose record offers, you know, tremendous things to admire, but also things that are often off-putting for some people.
Okay, and what happens then? 1931, the trial that he's cross-examined Hitler is over. Reichstag fire is what night?
It's February 27th, 1933.
What happens to Litton then?
You can imagine, given what he had done to Hitler, given this three-hour, very public, very well-documented humiliation that he had delivered to Hitler, because he had succeeded in making absolutely clear these contradictions that we've talked about within Hitler's movement and within Hitler's attitude to legality. All of this came out.
I should say, Hitler, that in saying that, you know, I remember when I first ran into Litton, I tried to find very much on the cross-examination and could not. And what you've done here is reproduce as much as you can of the cross-examination, and that's another part of the story, how you did that. But go forward with then what happened after 31, and then let's talk about how you got that cross-examination.
Sure. Hitler had come within an ace of getting prosecuted for perjury as a result of Litton's cross-examination. He was investigated. Hitler had to give a deposition to the authorities explaining why he hadn't perjured himself, and the authorities mulled this over. By the autumn of 1931, had decided not to prosecute him, but it had
Hitler was actually looked at for perjury?
He was looked at for perjury, absolutely, as a result of this. So this is something that shows, I think, how well-conceived Litton's strategy was and just how close he had pushed Hitler to very serious jeopardy. However, as we know, sadly, it didn't happen. Hitler didn't get prosecuted for perjury. We come now to February 1933. Hitler is now chancellor. And after 4 weeks as chancellor comes the Reichstag fire, which served Hitler's new government as a pretext, basically, to completely gut the Weimar Constitution, in particular, all protections for individual liberties and freedoms, in particular in the criminal justice system. And what followed that very night was the arrest of about 5,000 people across Germany whom the Nazis had identified as opponents or potential opponents, and Litton was one of them. So he was arrested and taken first to the Berlin police station, and then over a long process dragged from infant concentration camp to infant concentration camp. The concentration camps began springing up very soon on in the Nazi period of rule. And he started to suffer and be exposed to barbarities that are unbearable to even think about and read about. It was certainly painful for me doing the research and the writing of these parts of the book, and I imagine it's not always the most pleasant read, but it underscores what this man had to suffer. He was beaten, tortured repeatedly. The Nazis wanted to interrogate him for information on his clients, who by and large had been leftists. And through all of this, Litton showed an absolutely remarkable physical courage and an absolutely remarkable solidarity with clients that he refused to betray, even under torture, even under the most unbearable imaginable beatings and so on. And in a sense, this dragged on for years. By about the end of 1933, the authorities had clearly decided they probably wouldn't get much information from him. He had even gone so far as to try to take his own life so that he wouldn't betray his clients, the remarkable dedication to attorney-client privilege. Even though the authorities had decided they wouldn't probably be able to pump this man for much information, they would not let him go. And what opened up now was a long, heartbreaking period of years in which Litton's mother and certain other friends and family members and many prominent people abroad, political figures from Great Britain and elsewhere, campaigned publicly and privately for Litton's release from the various concentration camps he was in, always running up against the wall, always running up against Nazi authorities saying, no, this man is too dangerous. He will go abroad and he will spread propaganda. There's no way we can let him out. This kept up year in, year out, until finally, by early 1938, Litton was so broken, really, after 5 years of this brutal treatment. And he recognized, I think, correctly at that point, that he was never going to get out. And he told a number of his friends in Dachau, I said at the outset, I'll give this 5 years and then I'll make an end of it. And at about the precise 5-year point, as a matter of fact, in early February 1938, he took his own life in the Dachau concentration camp.
Now, this part of the story I know is extremely well documented and very moving as I went through it. And, you know, even before I read the book, it was the one part of Litton's story that I knew a little bit about because his mother wrote this book called Beyond Tears.
Yes.
And I remember, as I said to you on the phone when we talked about it, I said, I suspected there might have been a Jewish link there, but his mother never mentioned it all in the book. This entire book that was written in 1941, I think.
Yes.
And he was a well-known figure. I mean, there was an article in The Nation about him and everything in 1941.
Yes.
But it never mentioned that he was Jewish. And I asked you, well, what's that about?
Irmgard Litton's book, his mother's book, in which she wrote, as you say, about really these last 5 years of his life and her brave and determined and ultimately heartbreaking efforts to free him. She wrote the book with a very particular aim in mind. She wrote it after she had gone into exile in Great Britain after Hans Litton's death. She was quite frank about this, too, in her later years. She was advised that the book that she wrote should be shaped in a certain way to appeal to certain kinds of people. What she wanted to do, really, was rally opinion in Great Britain and America against Nazi Germany. She started writing the book just before the war had broken out, so it was important to her to try and rally opposition to Hitler's Germany. She also wanted to try and rally people within Germany, especially some of the people in the conservative establishment in Germany, people like in the diplomatic corps and the army, who she knew from social connections. The Litton family was a very, very well-connected family. These were people she knew, and this was a world that she knew. And she wanted to try and rally conservative Germans to split them from the Nazis. And her thinking was, if you can split some of the sort of establishment conservatives from the Nazis, you can drive a wedge through this regime and possibly break it down. And she thought that under the circumstances of the time, late 1930s, early 1940s, that to achieve this goal, to appeal especially to conservatives within Germany, Litton would be a much more, in a sense, successful figure, a successful advertising figure, if he was presented as Christian rather than Jewish. And so her book really, really suppresses the Jewish side of Litton's background.
You can't find it in there. I mean, it's not there as far as
I think there's
tell.
Maybe one or two glancing references.
I didn't really get it.
But it's, yes, you would. it's very easy to miss, and people did miss it.
A reflection that I had really when I heard his story and when I read your book, of course, is, and one thing that interested me a great deal is the parallels till today, of today. And of course, one thing that I had early on was that, when his mother went to the Nazis, who she knew because, as you said, social connections, and they said, and she said, I want to get a lawyer. And they said, you don't need a lawyer. He's in, I think they called it protective custody.
That was the euphemism for being put in a concentration camp.
And the interrogation techniques were what, called enhanced interrogation techniques or something, or the torture stuff, something like that.
I think they did have
something like that. So the parallels of keeping people in custody without allowing them to go to a court and test their detention were very, very strong for me. That's one part of it. And I'd like to comment on that, as well as comment on really the whole idea of what I think what you said, what happens when the rule of law is no longer really something that is taken seriously in the courts or is malleable or flexible or something.
To me, that's an important theme of the book. And one of the points I make in the book is that you can see the rule of law in Germany, in a sense, going into decay, going into a declining arc from at least a couple of years before the Nazis come to power. There was a process here. There were some extremely right-wing administrations, the Papen administration and the Schleicher administration right before Hitler's, who also had something approaching contempt for the rule of law and who also did their bit to erode civil liberties, bring in new legal procedures, new forms of courts, especially in political cases. Of course, this all gets drastically worse under the Nazis, there's no question. And there are certain things, I think, from a contemporary standpoint that jump out at you in this narrative. I quote something in the book from a man named Werner Best. And Werner Best was essentially the deputy leader of the Gestapo, the infamous secret police of the Nazi regime. And he was a trained lawyer, and so he was sort of the head legal officer of the Gestapo. And in 1935, he wrote a memo about the legal representation or the potential for legal representation of prisoners in the concentration camps in protective custody, as they euphemistically said. And at that point, in 1935, this is not yet the time of the Holocaust. People in concentration camps in 1935 are like Hans Litten. They're political prisoners, basically. They are people who are there because they're opponents of the Nazis. And so Werner Best wrote, this is not the exact words, but this is essentially a paraphrase of what he said. He said, in this time of national emergency, we cannot let the procedures of the judicial system come into this concentration camp system. He was basically saying it's too dangerous to do that. National security requires that these prisoners be locked up.
And I remind our listeners, we're speaking with Benjamin Carter Hett, author of an extraordinary book, Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. One of the intriguing statements you make in this book is really an example of how people should act in the face of injustice. Yeah. And I think this book is a lesson about that and a discussion of it, but you also say it's a double-edged sword.
Yes.
You sort of say Litten, yeah, he acted bravely, but there were consequences for acting bravely and not just
yes.
to him.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little more?
Sure, yeah. Litten was a thoughtful, dare I say, deep man, and he thought a lot about what he did. On the one level, there's no question Litten was a man who sacrificed himself, quite literally sacrificed himself for his beliefs. He could have gotten out of Germany before Hitler arrested him. Friends and family said to him, it's time to go, get out. And Litten steadfastly refused. He said, no, my clients need me. The workers can't get out, so I have to stay. He quite openly sacrificed himself for his dedication to his clients, to their vision of a better society, and in a certain sense to the rule of law. His very close friends, Max and Margot First, who risked their lives and very nearly lost them trying to free him. They arranged an escape attempt from the concentration camp, which went awry. Margot was arrested and imprisoned, and Max ended up in a concentration camp for a while. They eventually got away. These were people, again, who their bravery and nobility, I think, is one of the really strong, appealing elements of this story to me, partly why I wanted to write the book, to sort of just do honor to the nobility, really, of these people. At the same time, Litten himself once wrote in a very striking essay about what he called the double edge of the deed, and he wrote that it is impossible to do good anywhere without the flip side of that doing harm somewhere else. He said, that's impossible. And his own life and his own career shows that. I talk quite a bit in the book about the costs to his family of his advocacy. This was something that was really movingly brought home to me when I spoke to Hans Litten's niece, a lady named Patricia Litten, who's the daughter of Hans's youngest brother.
We talked about the cross-examination, and as I said, it's fully reproduced in the appendix, and of course parts are used in the text of the book itself. But how did you put it together? Where did you find it? How's it different than what we do here with cross-examinations today?
It's one of the challenges, actually, of doing research on German trials, and this is something I've done quite a bit of. I wrote a previous book, too, that dealt with German trials. They were never and are not now stenographically recorded officially in the way that American proceedings are. So if you want to find out what was said in a German courtroom, it can be a challenge. And really the source that you have is the newspapers. Back in the Weimar days, the newspaper reports were much more extensive than they are today. And if a trial was in any way interesting to the public, or newspapers assumed it would be interesting to the public, they would send stenographers to court and they would record it. And the newspapers would run transcripts, not always full transcripts, sometimes partial transcripts, but to some extent transcripts they would run in the papers. And since the Litten's cross-examination of Hitler was such a sensational event and there was tremendous public interest in this, really all of the major newspapers in Germany sent reporters to that courtroom, and they all had transcriptions. And you can go to really any major newspaper in Germany from May of 1931, and you'll see transcripts of the cross-examination. The challenging thing is they're all a little bit different. you know, and some of it you can easily imagine why. The newspaper world of Weimar Germany was incredibly diverse in terms of the ideological spectrum. You had communist papers, you had Nazi papers, you had liberal papers, you had Catholic papers, you had social democratic papers, everything. So to some extent, they all have their axe to grind, and you can see how this sort of precipitates out in the transcript. And then some of it is just sort of natural factors, human error. One reporter catches this and not that. An editor decides this part's interesting and not that. You know, you can imagine all that would go on. So all the transcripts are a little bit different. The transcript I have here is sort of inevitably, necessarily, I think, it has to be sort of pieced together. There's one transcript which seems to me to be clearly better than all the others. It's the one that ran in the paper that was kind of the equivalent of the New York Times in Berlin of the day, a paper called the Berliner Tageblatt, which I translate in the book as the Berlin Daily News. And the Tageblatt ran a very long, extensive transcript. From the journalistic reputation of that paper, you can pretty much assume that it would be reasonably accurate. The Tageblatt was a moderate liberal paper, so it didn't have a really strong extra grind one way or the other, in this case ideologically. And so that transcript is sort of the basis of what I've done, but I've augmented it in places where I think that the transcript in the Tageblatt might not be right, or where there's additional information from one of the other newspapers that seems to me to be plausible, a likely representation of what was said. So my transcript is a bit of a collage in a way.
Benjamin Carter Hett, author of Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand, a really remarkable book about the role of a heroic lawyer, the role of law in pre-Nazi Germany, and with shockingly, with unfortunately, some analogies till today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.